This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And my co-host is not CJ Christopher John O'Shea. It is not Tommaso Vincenzo Giuseppe Bonvissuto, but it is Graham. What's your middle name?
Pierce.
Oh, that's fantastic. Pierce, yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Graham Pierce Ewing.
That's right.
And any more to that? Like the 13th or something like that? Graham Pierce Ewing the 13th?
I'm the first.
You're the first.
I'm the one and only.
And that's the next generation of planners in our company that is coming on the air tonight for his debut. Are you excited?
I'm excited. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're going to be here many more times too, Graham Pierce. Can I just call you Pierce for short?
I guess so. I might not respond all the time, but I guess.
Anyway, we're here on an open show tonight, and so if you want to call in and ask a question, 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. Unless you'd rather listen to me talk to Graham about all kinds of different things and you want to direct the conversation of the show tonight, best thing to do is call 410-922-6680 and ask the question that's most pressing on your mind, whether it's estate planning or income taxes. A lot of things going on in income taxes right now. A lot of people thinking about it. And if it's investments or if it's insurance products, maybe you have somebody's telling you, you ought to do this, you know, man, you know, this is a great thing to do. And you're just curious, is it really a good thing to do? Whatever, elder care issues, mortgages, refis, reverse mortgages, anything that's pressing to you, if you want to ask that question, 410-922-6680. You get to direct the conversation tonight because we are on an open show tonight. So while we're waiting to see if anybody does want to ask us any questions, we got a Drew's View tonight. And you know what? One of the most common questions that I'm being asked right now, Graham, is people are saying to me, you know, the stock market is up so much. It's in nosebleed territory, and it just goes up and up. And, you know, I just can't do this forever and ever and ever and so forth. Okay, so I say to him, I said, you know what the stock, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was in the year 2000?
What?
And they say, well, no, what? And I said, it was 11,300.
Mm-hmm.
I said, do you know what the S&P 500 was in 2000? They said, no, what? 1550. I said, you know what the NASDAQ was? It was 5,100. And they go, okay, so what's the point? I said, well, it's 17 years later. The Dow Jones Industrial is at 20,700. So that it hasn't even doubled. In 17 years, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has not doubled. Do you know what that means? That in 17 years, that means the market is doing, on average, 4% a year since the year 2000. The S&P 500 is gone from 1550 to 23-something. It's up about 800 points. That means it's not even up 50%. Or it's up just over 50%, I should say.
Wow.
That means the market has only done about a 2% rate of return. And the NASDAQ is at 5,800. And so that means it's only up about 700 or 800 points in 17 years on a 5,100-point average. That means it's up just about 15% since the year 2000, 17 years, it's up only cumulatively 15%. That's less than a 1% compounded annual rate of return. My point is that the stock market really has just been coming back to the mean. It's just been reverting back to the mean since the year 2000, you know, where you had this big bull market run from 1982 to 2000, and now all of a sudden the market has come back that it hasn't had a very big rate of return since 2000 to 2017. Well, people say, yeah, but since 2009 it's up like 300%. Yeah, but it was down 60%. You know, the in 2009 when Barack Obama took office, the S&P 500 was at 666. And as I said, in 2000, it had hit 1550. So for it to just recover, it had to go up over 150%, just shy of 200%. And yeah. So now it's just up to 2300. It's really just, you know, just kind of recovering.
It's coming back.
It's just coming back. It's just recovering. So if it took off, it really would just get back to the means of what it has typically done over the last 100 years or so.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're on an open show tonight. If you want to call and direct the conversation, it's 410-922-6680. I have Washington on the line. Washington, how can we help you?
Hello, Drew. How are you?
We're doing great. And you?
Okay.
Well, that's good. What can I do for you?
Yes, I had to open up a line of credit, open up a credit card because I didn't have a Visa card, and there's only one merchant that we don't normally deal with that only handles Visas.
Like Costco.
Yes, like Costco.
Or BJ's.
Okay.
Does BJ? No, I think BJ's takes anyone, don't they? So well, anyway, go ahead.
Right, but anyway, there's another merchant I'm thinking of going ahead and getting it. I don't see myself using it that much with them. It's just that they have some sort of particularly certain loyalty situations that may come up every so often that it would be nice to have. I take it that having those small lines of credit available isn't really going to hurt things one way or the other. Is that correct?
Normally it won't, you know. It just depends on how much credit you have and how much credit's available and what you're using and your timeliness. But, yeah, if you just open up another credit card, you know, and you don't carry balances, you know, it should, you know, actually, funny, in my own credit score, I increased my credit line with one of my credit cards by a substantial amount, and my credit score went up dramatically because it said I have more available credit to keep myself afloat, and that was a good thing. Yeah. So who knows how they come up with the logic they come up with, but actually more credit, Washington, actually proves to be a good thing for most people. So it all depends on some of those other factors. So, no, I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, Washington, one of the biggest things that you're saying is credit utilization is what it's called. And the lower the percentage, the better it is for you. And it's definitely one of the weightings that is higher than just simply opening or closing a card.
All right, Washington, I got to go.
All right, well, thank you very much.
All right. Credit utilization, that's a very cool. Yeah. So if I have 100,000 of credit and I'm only using 2,000 of it, they actually like that.
They like it.
Anyway, we got to take a pause for traffic. We'll be right back. We're on an open show, 410-922-6680. Take it away, traffic. We're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth, with Graham Pierce Ewing.
That's
and,
right.
And you ever surf?
No, but I like the song.
You like the song, but yeah. You've never surfed.
Never surfed.
All right, that's cool. I've never even thought about it.
No.
That's even funnier.
I'm surprised.
I've never even thought about wanting to surf. Can you
now
believe
you have.
That?
Now
can
you believe?
No, I didn't think about it.
Oh, you were okay.
I was thinking about not thinking about surfing.
Gotcha.
Anyway, we're on an open show. If you want to call and ask a question, we'd have nobody on the line. Nobody wants to talk to me. You're going to get, you know.
I'll talk to you, Drew.
You can talk to me in a second, but I have to try to coax my listeners. If there are there's two of them out there that want to call in, 410-922-6680. If you want to call in and ask a question, direct the conversation so that the conversation is going in the direction that you want to hear about, you're interested in, that you think this is what I want to hear about. That's why we do this show. We do this show because we want to demonstrate what true professional financial advising is without a bias, without selling product, without telling people, you know, call our office today. We got a great product. You know, we're going to do this and that. Mm-hmm. We just want to answer questions for people and demonstrate what a true professional advisor does. And if people want to call us, you know, after they hear how we address things, we're happy to do that. But really, our whole goal is to educate. That's a mission of our company, mm-hmm. is to educate the public. So if you want to call in and ask your question, 410-922-6680. And you just got your CFP, Certified Financial Planner credential, what?
3 years ago.
What's it been that long?
Yeah. But well, actually, I passed the test 3 years ago. But then you need the experience. And
so you got that at the end of 15 or 14?
Beginning of 15.
Beginning of 15. And now you're in your master's program of financial planning.
I am, yeah.
How many years are you through that?
I'm about halfway through. Not quite.
You'll be ahead of me if you get a master's degree in financial planning.
Just in the letters behind my name.
But yeah, but I got
not
a
even that. You
I got a CPA,
CFP.
So you know you got to get.
Yeah.
How many will that give you?
I don't know. I guess just two.
Well, you'll have an MBA master's in financial planning, won't you?
Yes.
Because you're going to get an MBA with a concentration in financial planning.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. Yes, you will have more credentials in front of your name then. We're on an open show, 410-922-6680. We've got John on the line. We'll go to him in a second. But if you want to call in also, plenty of time for plenty of callers, 410-922-6680. John in Glen Burnie, how can we help you?
Yeah, hi. This is a question. I'm having a problem with my son. He's in his mid-20s, and he's got a good job, but he's become obsessed that the Federal Reserve is a bank that was initiated by private bankers, a couple of very rich billionaire families that are still owners of the bank, and that they manipulate the world through Federal Reserve nation banks to the whole world. Is there any scintilla of truth to this? And where can I find something that will sort of turn the other way if it's just a conspiracy theory?
Well, there's an incredible amount of truth to what he said. The problem is the interpretation of how he takes that news, okay? So in 1907, the world came to its knees financially. Now, there was a financial crisis similar to the 2008 crisis that we went through, okay? Now, if you understand the financial systems of the world, it all has to do with psychology, okay? And if nobody believes that anybody could bail this out, everyone's going to run for cover and the economy will collapse. So in 1907, there was a crisis of confidence, and in came J.P. Morgan. And J.P. Morgan said to the world and to the United States, I personally, the J.P. Morgan Bank, will back everything and anything just like the Federal Reserve did in 2008. Okay? When J.P. Morgan did that, confidence began to restore to the economic system, and they ultimately came out of that crash of 1907. 5-6 years later, the government said, and J.P. Morgan was with them, and he said, you know, guys, that was kind of a bluff I called, you know? But they responded to it, fortunately, but I don't have the firepower if they kept demanding me to back it up. And he said, what we need is an unlimited sort of source of money, and so we ought to create a national bank, a Federal Reserve, which had been done before. Hamilton made a national bank also, and so forth, but the Federal Reserve was created out of that in around 1913. And so it was a bunch of very rich bankers and billionaires in that day. They were only millionaires back then, but they would be billionaires in today's dollars. So they formed the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve does absolutely manipulate financial markets. There is no doubt about it. They even say it. They honestly admit it. They did quantitative easing. Why did they do quantitative easing? They very clearly said, we're doing this to manipulate interest rates lower on the long-term end so that people can refinance at cheaper and cheaper rates, et cetera, et cetera. So here comes the point, John. The point is that your son has absolute right information about who they are and what they do. The negative side is the interpretation. Are you going to interpret it as negative and evil? Are you going to interpret that it is for the good of all and it is very positive? And I lean more toward the positive. I do believe they do things occasionally that's not perfect, but it's better than the alternative, in my opinion. And I would not interpret it as negatively as many people do. How's that for an answer?
That sounds good.
All right?
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, buddy. You take care. So, do you have anything to add to that, Graham Pierce?
No, I think you took care of it.
All right.
Although, yeah. Pierce, I'm willing to bet a distant relative was part of the Federal Reserve.
Jim in White Marsh, how can we help you?
Yes, good evening. Thank you for your show here. I do appreciate it. A quick question. What's the difference between investing in someone like a T. Rowe Price, actively managed, and a Vanguard, which is passively managed? What's the difference in terms of cost and also in terms of the results?
Okay.
Speaking. This is
the ultimate question of the day. And right now, in today's world, the vanguards of the world are absolutely winning the debate that they're the better way to go. So what is the difference? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
In the about 50, 100 years ago even, they started to form indexes where they said, we're just going to take, well, who are the top 30 industrial companies of our country, or we're going to take the top 500 companies of our country, and we're just going to monitor them and see how they're doing to be able to determine whether the stock market's going up or down and whether our country's growing or not growing. So they really just created these as an economic indicator. They called it the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 Index. And so those went on sort of in and of themselves for quite a few years. And along in the 1970s, along comes John Bogle, and he does a study, and he looks at all these T. Rowe Price actively managed mutual funds and Oppenheimer and Merrill Lynch and whoever, you know, and all the companies out there that do actively managed mutual funds. And he said, you know what? If I just own the S&P 500, I would have outperformed 78% of all those actively managed mutual funds. If that is true, why would I want to do anything other than just to own the index of whatever S&P calls the top 500 companies? I just own that, and I don't manage it. I just buy them, and I hold them, period, until S&P says, well, we're taking Walmart out, and we're putting in, you know, Exxon or whatever the case may be. And so if S&P changes who the top 500 are, Vanguard switches it in and out, but there's no active management. There's no wondering, is it a good company or a bad company? Okay? And okay. Since Bogle said, okay, since I'm doing that, there's not a lot of management we have to do. There's not a lot of thinking we're doing. We don't have to hire a big staff. All we have to have is accounting people to keep track of what do they say is in the index and what's not in the index. So here's the difference. An actively managed fund can easily cost 0.5 to 1.5% per year. An index normally is not going to cost more than 0.1% per year. So the
wow.
difference in cost is dramatic, and the statistics say that most actively managed mutual funds do not outperform their indexes. And when I say most, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80%. And in many years, it's as high as 90% of all actively managed mutual funds do not outperform the indexes. Now, does that mean that actively managed mutual funds are totally junk? No, not in my opinion. But that's the argument. That's the question you asked. And that's the debate that goes on today.
Mm-hmm. So I'm paying 0.1 as opposed to 0.5 or 1.5. I mean, that's an extraordinary difference.
That's a big bogey for the active manager to have. You have to be a very good active manager to beat your index if you've got that much of a differential in cost. And that's what the argument is for what's called passive index investing. Is it right? I think there's a lot of good truth to it. I don't take it to the extreme that some do, but there's a lot of truth there, Jim. I got to run, but I hope that answers your question.
Very informative. Thank you.
All right. We got to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is that? The Turtles. Yeah, that's what I was going to guess, Chris. The Turtles. It Ain't Me, Babe. Yeah, that really, I think that was on the other side of the hit record, you know? I'm pretty sure. You know, it was on the other side of they're coming to take me away from the funny farm. It was the reverse of they're coming, so they played it backwards. They're coming to take me away to the
Sounds
honey
like
farm.
My kind of music.
And then if they, when you want, you turn the record over and you listen to the song on the other side and it was... Yeah. Anyway, that's trivia there that you didn't need to know. Rodney in Boston, we're going to you. We're on an open show, 410-922-6680 if you want to call in. Rodney, how can we help you?
Hey, Drew. Hey, Graham. Appreciate you taking my call. My wife and I made a resolution last year that we were going to start doing budgeting. We're already a month or two into the year. Haven't really gotten it off, gotten started with it. Wondering if you guys have any tips or tools as far as if somebody's looking to start budgeting for the first time, where they can either get advice or a tool to use or a book to read, something like that.
Well, I'm not a big budgeting guy. Do you budget, Graham?
No, I just keep track of what I spend.
So you monitor cash flow, which I believe is the absolute number one thing that every single listener, I don't care how old you are, if you have any concern about your money and how you spend it and spend it wisely, I think that every single person should be keeping track of their cash flow. In other words, where'd my money come from? Where's it going to?
Yeah.
And you should itemize it as much as possible. So I'm going to say, how much went to groceries? How much went to mortgage? How much went to insurance? How much went to car repairs? How much went to this? And then at the end of each month, I monitor it. I say, okay, how do they look? And then, and I try to do it in as much detail as possible. So instead of like doing dining, just, restaurants and things, I would break it out going out at night with wife, as opposed to going out during the day for lunch. I want to break that kind of, so I want to see those numbers, and I want to see the cumulative of what it is, and I want to see that my goals are being met, but I'm also not wasting money anywhere. So monitoring cash flow is probably the greatest financial thing. Some people are really good at budgeting, Rodney, and if you want to, the number one site I like is Mint.com.
Yeah.
Mint.com is free. It's by Intuit, and you can do all the budgeting, if you want to say, Jane, we are not going to spend more than $122 on the movies, and that's it. Once we spend $122, we're finished with movies, unless we move it from another bad budget category. Some people can do that and do it well. So Mint.com would help you do that, monitor, it'd send you alerts every time you hit one of those limits, and so forth. You need a budget.com. Well, I never can remember the letters.
YNAB.
Why you need a budget.com is another great one for budgeting. But again, my preference, Rodney, is just keeping track of cash flow. And we have a spreadsheet that we use. I think one of our associates, Mike, put that together for cash flow analysis.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, it's a very good one.
Debt? What should I pay off first?
What do you pay off first? I always pay off high debt with the lowest balance possible. So highest interest rate, lowest balance that I can pay off, but that's a whole talk in itself. I got to run right now. I got a lot of callers
here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Jim in Cadenceville, how can we help you?
Sir, good evening. I have a question on my IRA, which is invested in the stock market in various forms.
Okay.
Right now, it will all go to charity, and I have it set up right now with beneficiaries for four different charities.
Okay.
My problem is my RMD comes out of there and hits my taxable accounts.
So, Jim, that's an easy answer.
Well, wait a minute. Let me just ask the question I have in mind, though.
Okay.
If I put in a reverse, change that to an irrevocable trust.
No.
Can't do it.
Can't do it.
Okay.
But it's an easy answer.
Okay, go ahead.
How old are you?
85.
Your money's going to charity anyway, right?
Yeah.
Hasn't anybody told you about the qualified charitable distribution? You can send your RMD up to $100,000 per year to all four of those charities every year and never report that RMD on your tax return again.
All right. That's just a straight-out charitable contribution, then.
Charitable contribution. So let's say I have $300,000 in my IRA, and my RMD is those $30,000 this year, okay? And I've got my charity is the Baltimore Community Foundation. That's my charity of choice, and it's my beneficiary in my IRA. And I don't want that money going to my income tax return. I don't need it. I don't need it. So what I do is I go to my IRA custodian, and I say I want to do a qualified charitable distribution of my RMD right to the Baltimore Community Foundation. The $30,000 goes to Baltimore Community Foundation. They get it tax-free. I fulfilled my RMD requirement, and it does not show up on my tax return.
I'll look into that, then.
That's an easy one, Jim. You've got to do that. That'll slam dunk your taxes like you've never seen before.
Yeah, that damn RMD, man, is just killing me on tax.
Well, you got to learn about the qualified charitable distributions. Your charities will appreciate it. You'll appreciate it. It'll be a big win-win for both of you, okay?
Great. Well, I give the charity now out of RMDs, but what you're saying is...
You're going to give it direct.
Into my taxable column.
Yeah, you do it, and then you take it off your itemized deductions. It's a shame that no one's told you about this for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Oh, you could have been doing
what
this.
What is the name of that? I'll ask my broker.
Qualified Charitable Distribution.
Okay, will do, and I appreciate that.
All right, take care. I'm going to run. Where am I going? I'm going up here. Ernest in Baltimore City, how can we help you?
Hello, I have a question about the Federal Reserve. Is it true that the Federal Reserve lends money to the U.S. at interest, and the U.S. has to pay it back, but in order to pay the interest, has to borrow more money and more interest, and it keeps snowballing, and that way we never get out of debt? Is that true?
Well, I mean, technically that's true because nobody owns more U.S. Treasury bonds than the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve owns a few trillion dollars worth of U.S. Treasury bonds, and yes, the U.S. has to pay them interest because technically they're considered an independent bank. And so that is true. Now, is it true that they keep borrowing money because of that? No, that's not true. It's they keep borrowing money because they spend more than they make. That's a pretty easy one, right?
Well, how do they make money?
How does the Federal Reserve make money? Or how does the federal government make money?
The government.
Well, the government makes money by stealing it from us, confiscating it from us, and then spending it on what they feel they want to spend it on. But because they're so inefficient, no matter how much money they take from us, they continue to overspend what they take from us. So there's nothing wrong with them taking money from us. They deserve to take some money from us to run the country and keep it safe and so forth, and a lot of other good things that they do. But they don't have to be as ridiculously inefficient with what they take and coming up with all these new stupid programs they come up with day in and day out and day in and day out. So it's not the Federal Reserve, Ernest. It's the silly politicians that run the country very inefficiently. All right, I got to run. Good question. Very good question. You have a great night. And I got to go to traffic, and I'm going to be back for the last quarter hour of our show. Money, Riches, and Wealth, we're on the open show, 410-922-6680. Jerry, hold on. We're going to get right back to you when we get back. Take it away, Trav.
You need help organizing your financial life? You thought about what retirement looks like when you go beyond just the numbers? The financial physical is the first step in working together to organize your personal finances and your goals. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent fee-only firm. Call today to schedule your financial physical and experience the difference. Learn at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com or 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
He wasn't going to take any chances on that one since he really wasn't sure if he was successful on the last two. So he was going to go for a sure bet. There you go. Good job. Anyway, we're here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're on an open show. We have about 10 minutes left. We can probably take one or two more callers. I've got Jerry on the line. I'm going to go to him in a second. If you want to call in and direct the conversation of the show for the last 10 minutes, 410-922-6680. Jerry in Pasadena.
Hi, Drew. How you doing?
Doing great. And you?
Good, good. The question I have tonight is, what's your view on dollar value averaging?
Dollar value averaging. So let me explain to my listeners what you're asking. So let's say you have $500 a month that you could invest. Or let's say you had $50,000 to invest, but you're thinking, hey, the stock market looks to be really high. Instead of putting it all in the market right this minute, I'll just start investing $1,000 a month for the next 50 months, and then I'll average into the market. So if it goes down, I'll be buying lower, and if it goes up, I'll be buying higher. But in the end, if the market doesn't do a lot, you know, or if it goes down a lot for the next few years, my average price will be lower over that period of time. You know, the answer to that question is, it's dollar cost averaging is
Drew. Yeah. Excuse me, I'm referring to dollar cost averaging.
Okay.
To dollar value averaging.
Dollar value averaging.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you tell me what dollar value is. But that's a new marketing term, because that's not necessarily a full legal term, financial
okay.
term.
What,
go ahead.
What it is? Let's use your example of $50,000 to start, and so the first month I want to put $1,000 in, and at the end of the second month I want the value of that account, whatever it is, to be $2,000. So if the market goes up, and let's say it goes up and it's worth $1,300, then I have to put $700 in to make it $2,000. And then let's say the next month, it drops, and then I'd have to put like maybe more in, maybe more than $1,000 to get it up to $3,000 for the next month.
I've been around a long time, and I tell you the truth, that's the first time I've ever heard of it. You ever heard of that, Graham? You've
no.
got a master's degree in this stuff, and I only have a CPA, CFP for 35 years, so it's the first time I've ever heard of it, Jerry.
In looking at it, it looks like you're guaranteed to buy low and guaranteed to sell high if you have the capital when it goes low to put in to bring it up to the value that you want it to. To me, that would be like the one drawback to that as I was thinking about this.
What if the market is in like a 2009 type scenario and all it does is go up for the next 8 years, and there's other than an occasional downturn, how would that really work? I mean, I'm not necessarily sure how the concept really helps you any. I hear what you're saying, but you'd have to do some mathematical calculations. You know, are there people out there that have done calculations to show in up markets and down markets what it's done for you?
I don't know the answer to that. That's why I'm calling you.
Yeah, well, it's the first time I've ever heard of it. So, I'm trying to see if there's some academician analysis on the concept. You know, dollar cost averaging makes perfect sense for somebody who doesn't have a lot of money and is
right.
just going. It's like with the 401k. People who invest in their 401k every paycheck are dollar cost averaging. They're just continuing to buy in, and if the market goes down, they continue to buy in at lower prices, and it comes back, it goes back.
Let me use your 2009 example where the market continued to go up. So let's say at the end of month two, where I wanted my value to be $2,000, but let's say the market really went up that month and was actually $2,300. Then I would actually take $300 out, put that in my pocket, because it exceeded the value I wanted the account to be at the end of that month.
Yeah, but it sounds like, over the next 7 years, you would have lost the opportunity on that $300, and that would have hurt you. So I think your concept in dollar value is on a flat market where you get sharp, volatile spikes up and down. In a volatile, flat market, I think the concept works great. In an up market, I think you're going to hurt yourself with it. And in a down market, you're just going to be plowing more and more and more money in the market, which is what specialists do. You know, and that's an interesting concept. You know, the specialists in the stock market, they're the ones
right.
that keep the market, so they automatically do buy low and sell high. If you understand how a specialist works, your dollar value concept is not the same And I think it would only work in a volatile flat market, but I'd love to see an academic study on the concept to see if it would actually work over a period of time. So unfortunately, it's a new one on me. I think it's one of the first times I think I've ever said that, but you know, it's an interesting concept. We're going to look into it. All right?
Okay, great.
Thanks, buddy. Good. You know, I always like to learn new things, and that sounds interesting. Nick in Elk Ridge. The Nick Man. How are you doing?
Good, Drew. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's up?
Hey, listen, I'm fascinated with the Federal Reserve. And I know
in a good way or a bad way?
Well, I don't completely trust them. Let's just say that.
Okay.
Rand Paul, he's been trying to audit them, him and his dad, for the last, I don't know, umpteen years. And it seems like they don't want it. But isn't it true? My question to you was, where does the Federal Reserve get their money? Don't they just print it up out of thin air?
That is true to some degree, but it's not 100% true. They are a bank, and they do have fees, and they do have money they make on their portfolio, and they do lend occasionally to...
But aren't they a private bank, and they have really nothing to do with the federal government?
Technically, that is absolutely correct. They're supposed to be an absolutely independent bank, and the independence of the Federal Reserve is extremely important, and such that the politicians cannot influence them as to how much money to print. Because look at countries like Mozambique or Argentina, where the government has a lot of control over, you know, what the Federal Reserve does in those countries. You know, you cause serious problems in those countries when the Federal Reserve Bank is not independent. So in developed countries who have low inflation rates, the Federal Reserve is independent. Now, I was talking about Graham about this at the break, and I said, if I had my way with the Federal Reserve, I would put them on much more on autopilot, where they can't make a lot of the decisions they make, but they're ready for those unique periods of time like 2008, where they come in and say, like J.P. Morgan, I guarantee everything, you know, just to restore the confidence in the market. But otherwise, this bull about quantitative easing and we're going to adjust interest rates and we've got this mandate and that mandate and we're going to do this, I think that's phony baloney in a lot of ways. And so,
yeah, but can't they create inflation and stem inflation depending on how much money they print and put into the market?
Absolutely, but as you've seen over the last 9 years or 8 years, they've printed now, Nick, $3 trillion. In 2008, when the crash came in, they only had a balance sheet of $800 billion. Today, their balance sheet is $4 trillion. $4 trillion.
Right.
So they printed $3.2 trillion and were unable to move the inflation scale hardly an iota. And so, you know, yes, they can. If they just kept printing and printing and printing, and especially if they printed and just gave it to the government, which is what a lot of the bad countries of the world do, then they could definitely. But, you know, and every time we've had a recession before 2008, it was always Federal Reserve induced to slow the rate of inflation down. 2008 was a unique period of time because the Federal Reserve did not induce it. It happened naturally because of the debt bubble that had happened. Great conversation, Nick. We ought to bring a Federal Reserve expert on and have a lot more conversation about it. Sorry.
I'd love to do that. I think that'd be great.
All right, buddy. You take care. I got to run. And Graham Pierce,
thanks.
You did a great job on your first debut tonight.
Thanks, Drew.
And we look forward to have you back, the next generation of the Financial Consulate. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.